Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots, and your moderator for today's program. Today, we're talking with a panel of Palestinian experts about the future of Palestine. According to a news assessment from the West Bank, the mood among Palestinians is, quote-unquote, gloomy, though Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, is still publicly hopeful that Palestinians will live in a state called Palestine. Palestinians themselves have voiced their fears and exasperation, not just at Israel, but at the divide between Abbas's Fatah party and that of Hamas. A Palestinian man in Ramallah told the Reuters news agency, "We will not see progress in the peace process in the coming years." How accurate is this prediction? With a new administration in the United States and one about to take shape in Israel, and with Egypt, Russia, and other countries eager to broker peace talks in the Middle East, are we finally at a point of potential progress? To answer these and other questions, the Commonwealth Club has brought together four Palestinian experts, each of whom brings a unique and important viewpoint to the discussion. Our panelists are Omar Dejani, former senior legal advisor for the Palestine Liberation Organization's Negotiations Support Unit, and former political advisor for United Nations Special Envoy, Terry A. Rode Larson. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. We have George Bisharat, professor of law at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law and an expert in Middle East affairs. He's written extensively on Palestinian issues and has a forthcoming book. We have Jamal Dejani, producer and senior director of Middle East programming for Link TV, a commentator, Peabody Award winner, and Gaza crisis blogger for the Huffington Post. And finally, we have Jess Ghanam, clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and past president of San Francisco's Arab Cultural and Community Center. He's been to Palestine many, many times. First question, let's direct this to Omar Dejani. Professor Dejani, you've written recently about the hopeful future and about the hope that is seen in the administration of President Barack Obama. And you say that President Obama can actually change the equation in the Middle East and actually perhaps lead to a state of Palestine. In 2003, I interviewed Edward Said, who at that point said he envisioned a state of Palestine by the end of this decade. What is your feeling about this timetable, as it were, and also about the Obama administration and its chances for steering peace in the right direction?
I think it's a difficult moment to be optimistic. Much will turn on whether the Obama administration decides to reverse two critical policy decisions that have been taken by both the Clinton and Bush administrations and some administrations in the past with respect to solving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The first of those policy decisions was the view that the United States can't bring the parties to an agreement through intervention of its own, that it should that it couldn't want peace more than the parties, as Dennis Ross used to say, and accordingly that everything should be left to negotiation. The second of those policy prescriptions was that capacity should precede commitment, that if we wanted to see peace in the Middle East, that what we needed to do was build up the Palestinian Authority, work on security reform, work on political reform, and only when Palestine was effectively Switzerland could we then turn to negotiating peace. I think that the problems with both of those approaches have become manifest. I think to the extent that the Obama administration is prepared, first of all, to do what I think a growing number of people are arguing it should, people ranging from former national security advisors like Zbigniew Brzezinski to heads of important Jewish organizations in the United States, Isaac Luria over at J Street, M.J. Rosenberg over at Israel Policy Forum, Henry Siegman at the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as former members of the Israeli government like Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was Israel's foreign minister during the Barak government. I think that what the chorus is calling for is the Obama administration proactively to articulate a set of parameters, parameters rooted in international law, and to take those parameters to the Security Council and say, international community, let's get behind an idea. What will peace look like? And let's lay that out for the parties, for the right and left in Israel, for Hamas and Fatah, and let's build it so that they will come. Let's give them a clear choice to make so that the publics on each side have a sense of, beyond all of the rhetoric, what the parties that claim to represent them really stand for. And I think that if we do that, and if we also focus on commitment as an avenue for building capacity rather than the other way around, what we'll see is more progress in this sort of Sisyphean project of strengthening the Palestinian Authority than we've seen before. And I'm happy to elaborate on that further, but perhaps I'll leave it to the other panelists.
Thank you for those comments. Let's go to Professor Bisharat. Professor Bisharat, you've written about the idea of a two-state solution, and you actually advocate or advocating a one-state solution. And in your thoughts on this, you argue that a one-state solution would actually be more beneficial to Palestinians, both with inside Israel and now who live now in the West Bank. This is an idea that is popular among some people, but can you talk about that as being maybe the best option that's left in this area?
I'd be happy to. Yes, I think, you know, the international consensus has finally come around regarding the two-state solution. Unfortunately, it has come to this stage only at a point when such a solution is no longer possible. And the impossibility is caused by Israel's substantial settlement of the West Bank. There are now approximately 500,000 Israeli settlers who live in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. And there are hundreds of settlement outposts and many settlements which are very large, essentially like small cities, which bisect the West Bank, together with their supporting infrastructure of security zones, Jewish-only or Israeli-only roads, electrical grids, etc., take up about 40% of the West Bank. And I don't believe that these people are going to be moved by any Israeli government anytime in the near future. And to boot, the two-state solution really doesn't offer a full restitution of the rights of all of the Palestinian people. There are approximately 1.4 million Palestinians who live as citizens of the State of Israel who do not enjoy equal rights in that state. The Palestinian legal organization called Adala, which is based in Israel, counts some 20 or so laws which on their face discriminate against Palestinians or privilege Jews over others, over non-Jews within the State of Israel. These people would benefit in no way from the establishment of a two-state solution. They would continue to live as second-class citizens within Israel. Moreover, the Palestinian refugees who now live outside of the borders of the state would have no genuine answer to their or vindication of their right to return to their homes and homeland, a right which was very shortly after their ethnic cleansing or their expulsion from Palestine was recognized by the international community. The fact of the matter is Gaza, which, by the way, 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip is constituted by refugees from southern what is now southern Israel, simply cannot absorb any more people. Neither can the West Bank really, practically speaking, absorb millions of Palestinians from the outside. So the fact is that a two-state solution will really serve as an end to the rights of Palestinian refugees to return. So for all of these reasons, I believe that the only fair solution for Palestinians and Israelis alike is to live in a state in which both peoples enjoy equal rights, both peoples have full political rights and access to resources. The fact of the matter is, since 1967, we have had a kind of a one-state solution. Mm-hmm. There's one functioning sovereignty that really determines the lives and the conditions of life for all of the people who live in former Mandate Palestine, and that is the Israeli government. The present reality, however, is that political rights are not evenly distributed. Only Israeli Jews enjoy full rights, and the rest suffer some form of lesser citizenship. So that is a condition which I think has to change, and that is, I think, the only circumstance in which full justice is going to be achieved for both peoples.
Thank you. Jamal Dajani, one of the things that you do is Mosaic, which is a program that takes news broadcasts and offers English, essentially, translations of them. You've been to Palestine recently, but let me just go back to Mosaic. On a recent segment, I saw several things that talked about the optimistic feeling among Palestinians, but also the pessimistic feeling. It seems to be both in a way. And you having been there, you're an expert on the media and so forth. Can you talk about the perception versus reality? In this country, we often get one idea, but it's more complicated than that when it comes to Palestinians.
Right. And again, the important part is the perception, because when we talk about Palestinians living in occupied Palestine, the Israeli occupation has managed to divide them into now literally four groups. So you cannot address the Palestinian issue without making a distinction between those who live in Gaza, that's one group, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, that's another group, Palestinians living in the West Bank, that's another group, and of course, Palestinians living in Jerusalem, they have also a different status. So now we have two or four competing public opinions united under one umbrella, which is really their national identity, but yet their conditions are totally different than say, you know, the Palestinians living in Jerusalem vis-a-vis the ones living in Gaza. So you cannot lump that all under one perception, because they have different needs. And I have to say, they were optimistic, you know, when slightly optimistic, I would say, with the election of Barack Obama. I happened to fly to Palestine on December 25th, just the day where I arrived on December 25th, on 25th, on Christmas Day, to work on a project there, to take a public poll and work on a segment interviewing both Palestinians and Israelis about their hopes and aspirations with the election of Barack Obama. Of course, we know what happened on the 26th, so I switched my energies and effort, and you could see a total drop in that opinion that we started on that was represented with hope, and that turned completely into despair and disenfranchisement, I would say, for anything that the future provides. I have to support what my colleague here, Professor George Bisharat, said, because I've worked also on a documentary back in 2005 and 2006, where literally for the first time in my life, even though I think I'm the only one on this panel that was born in Palestine and grew up in Jerusalem, this was the first time for me to travel extensively in the territory and talk to villagers in the West Bank, go to Gaza and talk, of course, you know, besides Jerusalem, besides the big cities and so forth. And the trust, and this is where we have to discuss our situation here from within, the trust in the negotiations, the trust in the Palestinian Authority mm-hmm. has pretty much dissipated. We have to be very honest amongst ourselves. The Palestinian Authority has been plagued with nepotism, cronyism, all kinds of mistakes from day one, from since Oslo has been launched. And when I talk to people privately, I mean, aside from the rhetoric, they would say, you know what, we just assume be the citizens of one state. We don't care. What do you call that state? as long as we have equal rights mm-hmm. and we can vote and we can participate. So on from the average, you know, when we talk about the man on the street, if there is such a definition as such, people are sick and tired of dealing with Fatah. They are sick and tired of dealing with Hamas. They are sick and tired of all these people that claim that they represent them. You know what? I don't believe even in the polls, scientific polls that are conducted. I'm talking about your average person as a reporter when I travel from village to village, from town to town. So for me, to tell you the truth, the concept of the two-state solution is dead now. And this might be shocking, but it's dead as long as we have the same leadership or the same old guards reshuffling themselves and claiming to be representing the vast majority of the Palestinians.
Thank you for that. Professor Ghanam, you've recently been to Palestine as well, and you've set up clinics there and so forth, and you've seen firsthand, this is before the war, what was happening there on the ground. You also have talked about how there's a pessimism there, even with the new Obama administration. That there's some reservation about what can possibly be done. From your standpoint, from someone who's witnessed it and has written about it, what is the best solution in a way, in the short term and the long term?
That's a very good question, and I think one of the things that people may not realize is that before the invasion that took place on the 26th, the situation in Gaza was really catastrophic. I mean, Palestinians living in Gaza had been subject to almost a two-year total siege where food, water, and medicine had been denied easy access. You had one of the few places on the planet where general indices of health and wellness were steadily declining on a, if not month-to-month, week-to-week basis. And generally speaking, I have to agree with my colleagues, Mr. Dejani and Professor Bisharat. I mean, the feeling in Gaza, having been there so many times, and I can say I've been there maybe 30, 35 times since 1993, that the image of a concept of a two-state solution really does not exist anymore in most people's minds. And I think part of the difficulty that we face in this country especially is that, and I know that my friend Jamal can speak to this even better than I, that the disjunction between what people see here in the media about Palestine and then what's really happening on the ground on a moment, day-to-day basis is completely disparate. I mean, it's as if they're speaking about two very different places. One place where this really came out was just the images that were being represented in Gaza from December 26th to January 20th, and the images that we were allowed to see here in this country really had no relevance or reality to Palestinians living in Gaza. I mean, the images are just catastrophic in terms of the devastation and the, you know, what the Israeli military did to lay waste to, you know, 1.5 million Palestinians living there. So when you ask me, like, what can be done, I mean, in the immediate term, and I have to say that one of the disappointments among Palestinians and among many Europeans that I've, you know, spoken with is that one of the disappointments with the Obama administration and with Obama himself in the beginning is that he failed to speak about the invasion and failed to call out exactly what was happening there. He says, well, you know, there can only be one president at a time. We barely had one president, obviously, but that goes without saying. But he felt free to speak about literally every other issue on the planet, but was painfully and noticeably silent about what was happening in Gaza. That left a very, I think, bitter taste in many people's mouth. And in addition, he didn't pick up the phone and say, hey, let the food, water, and medicine into Gaza. I mean, people know that even today as we speak, even though there's the, quote, ceasefire, which is not a ceasefire by any stretch of the imagination, Palestinians are getting killed every day. He never picked up the phone and said, at least let the food, water, and medicine in. You know, whatever, you know, militarily, but let the food, water, and medicine in. You need 800 truckloads a day into Gaza just to meet subsistence level of existence for Palestinians, and the Israelis are only letting in basically between 80 and 100 trucks a day. So Palestinians are on a less than starvation diet right now. In the immediate term, what we need is accountability of the abuses, the war crimes that have been alleged. There needs to be an accountability of that at every single level, and I'm hoping that Professors Bisharat and Dejani can speak to that. Secondly, there needs to be an immediate and massive attempt to infuse humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, because literally people are dying, children are dying. There's not a single functioning hospital anywhere in the Gaza Strip right now, which contravenes everything we know about the Geneva Convention and humanitarian law. Those are the immediate issues that I think need to be put on the table. But in terms of the long-term solutions, this may be one of the few times that you find three Palestinians all agreeing with each other. But I mean, I've been speaking about this and hearing about this since before 1993, but the inevitability of the one-state solution is like right in front of us. Everybody else sees it. In the rest of the world, when you see the reality on the ground, you see that the possibility, because of the settlements, as George spoke about, and the apartheid wall that is snaking its way through the West Bank, there just seems to be no other just and legitimate solution but the one-state solution.
Thank you for your thoughts. A reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with a panel of Palestinian experts about the future of Palestine. Our panelists are Omar Dejani, George Bisharat, Jamal Dejani, and Jess Ghanem. We're taking questions from the audience, and among the questions we have from the audience is the role of Palestinian leadership. You've addressed this in your response so far. 3 years ago, Rashid Khalidi wrote a book called The Iron Cage. Mm-hmm. And in that book, it surprised a lot of people. In that book, he talked about how there are a lot of factors that have contributed to the mess we're in. And one of them has actually been the Palestinian leadership. Mm-hmm. And as one example, he cited Yasser Arafat's support for Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. You've talked about this, all of you, a little bit here, but how important is it that there is a change, or not change in leadership, but how important is the Palestinian leadership in this question, or is it really a small factor relative to what the United States and Israel can do? And let's start with Omar Dejani.
I think that a transformation in the ways in which Palestinians are governed would be extraordinarily beneficial politically and economically. But having worked with the PA and the PLO and having had direct experience with their idiosyncrasies and frailties, I can say two things. Number one, there needs to be a change. But number two, I don't think that it's the lack of that change that has prevented progress toward peace in the Middle East. I think that bolstering the capacity of Palestinian leadership is critically important. But right now, what's even more important is creating a horizon that we can all march toward. And that is the single most critical means of building the capacity of the Palestinian leadership.
Professor Bisharat?
Well, I think it's important to point out that Rashid Khalidi's primary conclusion in that book, The Iron Cage, and the reason for its title, is in fact that there wasn't much that Palestinian leaders could have done differently that would have produced a different result. Mm-hmm. The Iron Cage that he referred to were the terms of the British Mandate, which basically locked in a set of policies that the Palestinians couldn't have opposed effectively. In fact, his only conclusion is things might have been different if the Palestinians had started resisting earlier and more stridently than they actually did. They were very nice. They were polite. They sent, you know, delegations to London to and they spoke to the world community about justice, and they were ignored. And the situation is not terribly different today. Moreover, Palestinians have not for a long time had an opportunity to choose their leadership freely, that is to say, without influence and pressure from the outside. And that's been particularly true of the last 5 years or so. Mahmoud Abbas, who is the head of the Palestinian Authority, the president of the Palestinian Authority, at least he was until January 9th when his term ran out, is somebody who has a very low approval rating. I think someone else on this panel can cite the specific figures.
13.5%.
Okay, thank you. And this is a man who, in important respects, has been propped up and supported on the one hand by Israel and on the other hand by the United States. Now, you know, we learned, we all know, for example, that Hamas took over leadership in sole governance in the Gaza Strip in June of 2007. What's rarely publicized in this country was that, in fact, a coup by Fatah to overthrow Hamas had been planned and was in the works with the support of both Israel and the United States. And this is all well detailed, has never been refuted in an article by David Rose in Vanity Fair, which I commend all of you to read. So, you know, what Palestinians need is for others to get out of their business and to construct a mechanism for a truly democratic choice. What has happened over time is a kind of a dual process. On the one hand, the sort of the downsizing of Palestine, that is the reduction of what's called Palestine to discontiguous little regions of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and then the domestication of the Palestinians themselves, that is the bringing of the Palestinians essentially under the influence and the control of Israel and backed by the United States. So if Palestinian leadership is to express the will of the Palestinian people, then all of these other powers and authorities need to butt out, and Palestinians themselves need to choose their own leaders free of influence and pressure from the outside.
Thank you. Let's go to Jamal Dajani.
Well, I'm not going to revisit old history going back to the Sykes-Picot and all the odds that were against the Palestinians from establishing their own state in 1947 to, you know, to 1948 war and so on. However, I did live under the Israeli occupation, okay? And I remember the years very clearly from 1967 onwards, where you have an entire population that was slowly stripped from its own identity. His land has been taken away. And let's remind everyone what happened in the 80s onward. The population that was under occupation at that time rebelled, and they rebelled against the occupation, and that was during the First Intifada. Now, the First Intifada, by and large, was a peaceful movement of civil disobedience, saying to the world, not just to Israel, enough. Enough of the occupation, because now what we see in the media and what we hear in, you know, on radio and on television, we have references to organizations, the Palestinian Authority, we have Fatah on one side, we have talks about Hamas and the attacks by Hamas, you know, using missiles against Israel. All of these conditions did not exist. We lived under Israeli occupation, basically under the boots of the Israelis. We resisted peacefully. There was mass demonstrations. And what happened? I mean, people were asking at that time for independence. They were asking for equal rights. And what happened was Israel started with the Palestinians, and I'm referring to the Oslo talks, and Israel went after the Palestinian, the so-called Palestinian leadership that was at that time in Tunis, and brought it to Gaza and Ramallah and Jericho. You remember Gaza and Jericho first, and thus created an entity where they can say to the world Now you have a representation and you have pretty much a country and you have a military force that we can attack it and we can create sieges on cities and starve people there. And this is the result that we see today. This is the result of the Oslo talks, the result of creating the Palestinian Authority. So when you talk to me about leadership, to me, I mean, I have one solution. The leadership should be dismantled. And I'm not going to pull punches. I've never worked for the Palestinian Authority or been part of Fatah or Hamas or any kind of organization there. And the leadership has failed the people. Now, I'm not giving, you know, a get-out-of-jail card to Israel. Israel, to me, you know, has done and committed all kinds of atrocities against the population that she was responsible for. You know, I'm not an attorney, so my colleagues can talk about the legal obligations for an occupying power for the population that it occupies. What was going on there? I mean, people talk about Gaza again. Gaza, during the happy times, the so-called of the happy times, you still had a crowded small area with more than 85% of its residents are refugees. I mean, if you go to Gaza, you go to areas in Gaza and you have camps, and the camps carry letters, A, B, C, D, and so forth. And the letters refer to the towns and the villages. You know, they call them Block A, Block B, almost like a jail, you know, what you call Block A, or Block A could be someone that came from Acre or Akko, as it's referred to. And this is where these people lived. And then they were given permission to work in Israel. But when they were there, they were paid slave labor wages. We talk about they were paid less than 15 cents on the dollar, if I want to equate that. Similarly, the people that were living in the West Bank, and they've seen slowly their hills and mountains and agricultural fields being taken over and settlements being erected there. Now, I myself, as a Jerusalemite whose family lived in Jerusalem for more than 1,200 years, if I leave Jerusalem for more than 6 months, or anyone, my Israeli identity card is confiscated. So in other words, the only way I can visit Jerusalem, you know, for me personally, would be as a tourist on my Israeli passport. While somebody like Avigdor Lieberman can come from Russia or wherever, and now he is controlling the Israeli Knesset. I mean, in his hands lie the future of Israel and the new Israeli government. So let's really look at the situation, how it was and how it is now, and see all the prospects and really make a decision, you know, as far as our as far as the Palestinian goes, the leadership that exists now, the one that is representing the Palestinians during all the talks with Israel, should submit the resignation to the Palestinian people.
Thank you, Jamal. Let's go to Professor Ghanem.
Well, look, there's plenty of blame to go around on this issue of leadership. And I think we're hoping that most of the people that are listening to us today understand the cataclysm that occurred in 1993, 92, and leading to 93, called the Oslo Agreement, because unequivocally, since the agreement of Oslo, which I might add was really condemned by many Palestinians, include Edward Said and a lot of academics and a lot of people on the ground, that the Oslo Agreement should not have been signed by any way, shape, or form. This was the so-called start of the peace process, as Jamal has been speaking about. Since that agreement has been signed, the situation for Palestinians, and I would say also for Israelis, has categorically worsened day by day, week by week, year by year. With respect to Palestinian leadership, I can tell you that Palestinian leadership in the PNA is perceived on the ground as not really representing Palestinians at all. very few people see the PNA, the Palestinian National Authority, as accurately or genuinely representing their aims or aspirations. They really perceive it as primarily representing the aims of American and Israeli interests. As long as that is there, I have to agree with Jamal. I mean, I think that the PNA has to be dismantled and people need to submit their resignations. And we have to turn everything upside down. Now, we'll talk about what that means hopefully a little bit later, but the current functionality of the Palestinian leadership is broken. Having said that, though, I want to go back to something Omar said, which is true. I mean, it doesn't matter who's the leadership. If there's an occupation, if there's a brutal occupation, if there are settlements, if there is an apartheid wall, if there is a siege on Gaza, it doesn't matter who's in leadership for the Palestinians. Because of this profound asymmetry between occupied and occupier, you know, no leadership can be empowered to actually do what they've been asked to do.
Thank you for the comments. A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with a panel of Palestinian experts about the future of Palestine. Our panelists are Omar Dejani, George Bisharat, Jamal Dejani, and Jess Gunham. We're taking questions from the audience, and several people in the audience have asked about Israel's response to the idea of a one-state solution. It's interesting, I think, for people to hear about this one-state idea, especially from the Palestinian perspective. But from the Israeli perspective, isn't it a non-starter? And in that sense, it's one thing to talk about this theoretical one-state solution, but practically speaking, how is it from Israel's standpoint? And I know Professor Dejani wanted to talk about this topic as well.
I think that one way in which you have four Palestinians agreeing around the table is that down the line, I think that there is a lot to commend the idea of one state in Israel and Palestine. The idea that Palestinians who would like to live in Jaffa or in Haifa one day will be able to, the idea that Jews who would like to live in Hebron or East Jerusalem at some point will be able to. And I think that that is an aim worth pursuing. But the question is how to get to that moment. And I think this may be where I part ways with my colleagues here on the panel, in that for a few reasons, one of which relates to Israeli public opinion, I think that pursuing a one-state solution without first undertaking to create two states and to build confidence between the two states and the two peoples living in them would be a poor strategy. I think it's number one, as far as Israelis are concerned, unfair as it may be, a characterization, they continue to understand the one-state solution as a prelude to genocide. And I think that that is unfair to the Palestinians in terms of characterizing them as genocidal, and I think that it reflects a lack of imagination in terms of what can be done on the ground. But I think that when you look at the results of the most recent elections in Israel, in which perhaps only one of the parties there, Hadash, which received four seats, would even have a discussion about a one-state solution, you get a sense about how difficult it is actually to rally Israeli public opinion in support of it. Secondly, I think while as destructive as settlement activity has been, and as difficult as it is to move 500,000 Israelis out of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, or to provide for land transfers to compensate for some of that territory so that Palestine would annex some territory that is currently within the State of Israel, as difficult as that is, it seems like a small thing compared to convincing the Israelis to accept millions of Palestinians return to the State of Israel. And the third thing I would say on this point is that the fact that 60 years later, with a significant Jewish majority in the State of Israel, there is, as George points out, such discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel, makes it, from a Palestinian perspective, not an attractive prospect to me for all Palestinians to be in the position that current Palestinian citizens of Israel are in. Because to my mind, their predicament will be only worse when Israelis perceive them not just as an other, not just as a troubling minority, but as the kind of threat that a majority there represents. And so in part because of how Israelis see this, and in part because I would like to see Palestinians given an opportunity for self-determination in the truest sense of that word, to sort of chart their own course before creating what I hope would be a more peaceable federal union between these two peoples, I would say better to start with two states, as difficult as it will be.
Professor Bishrat, do you want to check in?
Well, there's no doubt that at the current time, the vast majority of Israeli Jews are strongly against the notion of a single democratic state in Israel-Palestine. I happen to believe, and I've argued this in my writings, both legal and in the press, that both Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews have rights of self-determination in Palestine, and I believe that the only way that a single state solution can be brought about is through the mutual exercise, that is, the choice of both peoples to accept this solution. And what that means to me is that over time, Israelis have to be convinced to accept this. And that may seem improbable at this stage, but I don't believe that it's impossible. I think it will be a long-term process. I think it will be hastened by first of all, by the international community stating unequivocally to Israel that ethnic nationalism in a multicultural society just doesn't work. And this statement should be made peacefully, respectfully, even lovingly, one might say. And the statement should be backed up with a program of boycotts and sanctions and divestment. And the message should, I mean, I think the movement and the message has to be carried in a completely nonviolent manner. And I think over time, the appeal of this ideal will grow. And I'm going to cite an interesting authority for the power of a moral idea, and that is Ehud Olmert, the still current prime minister of Israel, who several years ago in interviews said what he feared the most was if the Palestinians shift from the Algerian model, that is, of national liberation, to the South African model. And he predicted that if this shift were made, and that's the shift that I'm recommending, one person, one vote in a single democratic state in a multicultural society, which is the way it is, if this shift were made, Zionism, the political ideology of establishing a predominantly or exclusively Jewish state in Palestine, would be finished. And interestingly, he further said that he expected among the strongest proponents, the strongest supporters for this ideal, would be young American Jews. And I believe he's right. I believe that many people in this country and elsewhere, when they are exposed to this idea, when they understand the situation on the ground, will see the obvious. Israel simply cannot go on discriminating against its own citizens, against refugees it has denied rights to for 60 years, and oppressing Palestinians under occupation. It has become only more militaristic, only more right-wing over time, only more aggressive. It has tried to impose its will and its presence via sheer brute force, and it has failed utterly in that project.
Jamal, would you like to...
Well, all I can say is look at the facts on the ground. You have already a one state. You have a one state, a de facto one state that controls everything between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and that's the state of Israel. In that state, you have two ethnicities. You have the Palestinians and you have the Israelis. And you have 1.5 million Palestinians now living in Israel proper, more than 400,000 Israelis living in the West Bank. Any which way you look at it, we have a de facto one state, but this state is the state of the, you know, for the haves and not and against the have-nots, which are the Palestinians. And what's wrong with demanding equal rights for all the citizens of that state? I know you said this is a no starter, but tell me what has been a starter for the Israelis. Can you cite for me one good example where the Israelis were willing to give up authority, control, and allow the Palestinians manage their own affairs? We hear in the media about Israel withdrawing from Gaza and giving up on Gaza, but what happened? Gaza is the largest open-air prison on earth. This is what Gaza, they control every ingress and egress out of Gaza. They control the airspace. They control the waters of Gaza. Palestinian fishermen cannot go beyond 6 miles from the coast of Gaza to fish for food. While if Israel has withdrawn out of Gaza, it should allow them something like 15 to 20 miles. Food, medicine, water, energy cannot go in and outside of Gaza without the permission of the Israelis. Palestinians living in Jerusalem, who I'm part of, have been living since 1967 under this suspended identity. We're neither Palestinians, we don't have Palestinian passports, and we are neither Israelis. We have what they call temporary residency cards. They're not even permanent cards. They're not even green cards like what the United States. So all the equations that you look at, on all the solutions have not worked. They have not worked since 1967. And we are wasting time. So when we talk about wait until new results or form a Palestinian state and then create a federation or some kind of other deal, what we've been saying, let's create another roadmap. We've done that, and it led us to nowhere. So every time we enter into these new negotiations about the so-called remnants of a Palestinian state, we lose time. We lose territory that we have been negotiating on. We started with 22% and they become 18%, then 15%, then 12%. And then now what we have, the current situation, is the Bantustans. This is the future of a Palestinian state. Well, I say no to that. I refuse to live in Bantustans, and I refuse to see the people that lived and farmed the land for centuries to be basically another apartheid South Africa, revisited. I mean, a redux of South Africa, that's not what we want. And look again at the current situation. It's a situation where you have both nationalities intermingled, and the only solution would be now is to move to that step and push forward for equal citizenship, equal rights, like anywhere else in the world.
Thank you, Jamal. Professor Ghanem.
Well, I think, the Israelis have to kind of wake up from a bit of denial that they've been under for 60 years or more. And I think what Jamal has just said is very consistent with my observations of what I've seen on the ground, because the facts on the ground speak to something very, very different. There has been no evidence since 1948, in my mind. I know you went to 1967, Jamal, but in my mind, there's been no evidence whatsoever of any attempt to create a peaceful solution to Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian rights, and Palestinian integrity, let alone the right of return. So what we have here in terms of the incredibly shrinking Palestine that has gone from, you know, 93% ownership of land in the 1940s, is that we've been squeezed, as Jamal has just said, we've been squeezed on less than 9% of historic Palestine. And then you couple that with the recent elections in Israel. And what would you feel as a Palestinian if you saw Avigdor Lieberman and Benjamin Netanyahu publicly and openly advocating for ethnic cleansing of indigenous Palestinian people? How would you feel as a Palestinian to see someone like that get up there and say, you know, this is not for you. This land is not for you. You know, you need to leave, and we're going to exercise as elected representatives, a policy to physically, forcibly remove you from your land. That doesn't sound like, a peace offering. And this notion of just wait till two states, I have to say, having been there so many times since the so-called Oslo agreements, I say so-called because it's not clear, you know, what was signed and who signed, but we do know exactly what has happened on the ground. And I can't imagine that there'd be any kind of currency or viability that you could say to any Palestinian in Gaza right now, just kind of wait a little bit. Maybe this two-state thing will work. I think it's delusional, frankly. I mean, and I think equally for Palestinians living in the West Bank right now, and that I think our job as people of conscience, our job as people who believe in rights for all people, you know, and I think this is where, you know, George said it very eloquently, you know, we need to make our case, and our case is people need to be treated with equal rights, with dignity, and that's the kind of model. Let's be very clear about it. There is a one state now. We've all kind of said it right now in various ways. There is a one state solution right now. And basically the transition from national liberation to equal rights for all is basically the argument that I think we're trying to make here.
Thank you. A reminder again for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with a panel of Palestinian experts about the future of Palestine. Our panelists are Omar Dejani, George Bisharat, Jamal Dejani, and Jess Ghanem. Professor Ghanem, you talk about the recent election in Israel, that you could say a shift to the hard line political blocks there. In the last several days, I've read various accounts of Palestinians who say they welcome this.
Yeah, I do too, actually.
And it surprised me to see this, but the logic is this. If there is a harsher government in Israel, that this will point out to the rest of the world who may or may not be watching this closely that this is exactly what's going on and this is what Palestinians have to face. Now, this seems counterintuitive to me, but can you talk about that just briefly if you can?
Oh, I think that's absolutely how I feel because it's how many, many Palestinians feel. They welcome I'm sorry to use this metaphor, they welcome the lifting of the veil on what Israel is really about. That's kind of a mixing of using of an interesting metaphor there. But I think there's a welcoming of the kind of bringing to the fore the reality of the racist, brutal nature of Israeli policies as it's being exercised on Palestinians living in Gaza, West Bank, and as the 1.5 million Palestinians living, you know, as Israeli citizens. There's a welcoming of that kind of breaking through of that reality into the narrative of the public discourse in this country. People know about it in other parts of the world, but in this country, that reality has been kind of denied or sequestered or not allowed as an appropriate narrative or discourse. And I think the reality of Avigdor Lieberman, the reality of Benjamin Netanyahu, and the reality of Zippy Livni, who uses nice language, but in fact has said on many occasions that if there were a two-state solution, that she would want the 1.5 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship to go to the West Bank or to go to Gaza. This is like unbelievable that this is coming from the most progressive person in the Israeli, among Israeli politicians. So I welcome that wholeheartedly. I think Americans and American foreign policy analysts and people in Washington should see clearly, unequivocally, what Israel is about and what the real policy is about.
Anyone among the panelists?
Well, I have to say I differ with my friend Jess on this. I I really don't welcome to see a racist, fascist government.
It's already there.
Neither I would welcome to see somebody who is a racist elected here to become a senator in this country or an anti-Semite becoming a Congress person. I don't think the election of Netanyahu is going to move the peace process forward or the rise in power and strength of Avigdor Lieberman, who has been, by the way, described by the Israeli many commentators in the Israeli media as a racist and a fascist. I mean, this is not a terminology that has been invented by Palestinians. I don't think that will be helpful to our future. I'm talking to our future. I'm talking about the future of Palestinians and the future of Israelis on either side. I don't want to see Palestinians going to the extreme right. I don't want to see Israelis going to the extreme right, because if you're talking about the no-starters, now here is the no-starter for you.
Yeah. Professor Bishra, do you want to add something on
just,
that?
Just briefly, you know, take Ehud Barak, who was prime minister of Israel during a good part of the Oslo years, and the man who is renowned, at least in the West, as the author of Israel's generous offer to the Palestinians. This is a man who, in his earlier life as a military person, participated in a raid in Beirut in which he either pulled the trigger himself or was in the room as the trigger was pulled to kill Kamal Nasser, who was a Palestinian journalist, member of the PLO, who was a very eloquent man. And his body was found with multiple wounds in his mouth, because he was a spokesperson, and in his right hand, because he was a writer. This is the left of Israeli politics. And under Barak, during the Oslo years, the rate of settlements increased. In fact, and the number in the span of years during the Oslo years approximately doubled. So the continuity in Israeli politics is territorial expansion and brutal repressive policies against Palestinians, whether they have been from the Labor Party or from any other party. So so that is the sense in which the veil is being lifted, as Jess has pointed out. The policies have always been the same, and now the politicians are simply not bothering to try to prettify them and conceal them as they have in the past.
Thank you, Professor Dejani. We're down to about 5 minutes now, and we'll take a few more questions. Actually, maybe just one more question from the audience. This question often comes up in the context of the Middle East, whether it's Israel, Palestine, or others, and that is the role of Arab countries in promoting dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians. As we talk here, Egypt is busy seemingly trying to bring Palestinian factions together so they can be organized. But is that a factor that is contributing to the peace process or not? And is it a factor that we should be paying attention to? Any one of you can address this.
I would point to two things. First of all, I think that the Arab Peace Initiative, which was launched in 2002 and then relaunched again in 2006 or 2007, which provides that if Israel is prepared to withdraw fully from the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, territories it occupied in 1967, agree to a just settlement of the refugee question, a just and agreed settlement, which is a language very similar to what President Clinton suggested years ago, that all 22 Arab states would be prepared the following day to recognize the state of Israel and to welcome it into the Middle East. And I think such a staggering offer is something that one would have expected would have been taken notice of to a greater extent in Israel. And I think that part of the reason that it hasn't is that our own government here in the United States acted fairly in a fairly lukewarm manner toward it. I think a consequence of the ideology of some of the leading stars of the neoconservative movement. I think that that Arab Peace Initiative remains one of the best ways, one of the best incentives for bringing Israelis to the table. And I think Israelis need to be reminded of it by everyone, particularly the U.S. The second thing I'd say with respect to negotiations about a reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas, I think that it's been a source of terrible embarrassment and shame on the part of both Fatah and Hamas that they haven't been able to reach an agreement. And I think that the Arab states can play a constructive role in facilitating that. But again, what will be critical will be the United States' role. In the past, the U.S. has said it doesn't want to see Fatah-Hamas reconciliation because it didn't want to see Hamas in a Palestinian government. That strategy has produced more loss of life and more instability, not just for Palestinians, but also for Israelis and other Arabs. Mm-hmm. And if the Americans will let the Arabs help, I think they can do a great deal, actually, to help.
Thank you. Anyone want to address that? If not, we have our final question. Several people in the audience have pointed out, and in this has been brought up here before, about the role of the Obama White House. One questioner asks, well, what, trying to read the tea leaves in a way, what does the appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and for that matter, George Mitchell as ambassador to the Middle East, what does this say in the short term about prospects for a peaceful Middle East?
Not much.
Not much. This is a professor.
No, I mean, it's like I guess I'm the one mixing metaphors here. It's old wine in new bottles. I mean, and that's the way it's being perceived. I hate to be the one that's so pessimistic on the panel, because if we had more time, you'd hear about my optimism, which I remain in some kind of interesting way. But in terms of specifically Obama, Mitchell, and Clinton, that is not a winning team just in terms of the history of Secretary of State Clinton, nor Mitchell for that matter. So, the folks that I talk to and speak with, and again, being on the ground with people, this is not something that people just kind of say, wow, I feel much better now.
Yeah, yes. Anyone?
I just say, action speaks louder than words. President Obama has delivered on some of his campaign promises, by picking up the telephone on day one and started calling all parties concerned in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, by giving his first televised interview on an Arab channel, Al Arabiya television, and, of course, the appointment of George Mitchell. However, I would say most people in the Middle East, and especially the Palestinians, they have the wait-and-see attitude. I mean, we've been given a lot of promises before, a lot of empty promises, and we want to see action.
Anyone else? If not, we'll go to one final question. And the final question is this. Several people have asked about, they describe them as Israeli Arabs or Palestinians, and you've talked about 1.4 million. What sort of factor are they in the whole process? You were talking about interviews with Palestinians in the West Bank, but what about Israeli Palestinians? Are they overwhelmingly supportive of a one-state solution? Are they mixed? And I know we have very little time to address this, but perhaps you can, one of you in 1 minute.
Well, I think there's increasing indication that the Palestinian citizens of Israel are strongly interested in democracy and equal rights, and there have been a number of notable statements by them in the last year and a half or so to that effect. The problem, of course, they live in a state in which there are substantial penalties for speaking out, frankly, in support of a single state. There is, part of Israeli law makes it illegal for political parties to run for office that do not subscribe to the notion of a Jewish democratic state. So merely speaking out for equal rights can result in their disqualification from election. And there were two parties in the last elections that were at least initially barred from running by the Central Elections Bureau. The Israeli High Court reversed that decision quickly. But the problem is, in other words, that it's very hard to speak frankly in support of this ideal, although there are strong indications that many Palestinian citizens of Israel support it.
Thank you. Thank you to all our panelists. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. Remember, we encourage you to continue this conversation by joining us on the internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.